There is enough DNA in a single cell to stretch 6 feet, yet it coils down to fit into a space a thousandth of an inch wide. There's enough DNA in a human body to reach from Pluto to the Sun, and within this DNA are stories that have been buried for millions of years. Whether that DNA reveals truths about sports, music, or Machiavellian microbes, its tales tell collectively a larger and more intricate story of the rise of human beings. In the new book, The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, is written by our genetic code, Sam Keen brings the same humor and insight that he used to make the periodic table of elements entertaining in his best-selling debut, The Disappearing Spoon. Again, the new book is The Violinist's Thumb, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Sam Keen to the roundtable this morning.
Hello, thanks for having me.
What brought you to this particular subject of looking at these tales?
Well, I knew there was a lot going on in genetics right now. It's really a field that has exploded in the past decade or so. And what really excited me about it was the chance to not only talk about what people normally think of with genetics, all of the medical work that's being done, but the chance to talk about a lot of other fields too. Genetics has really almost invaded basically every other field of biology and really expanded what we can do with things like human history or archaeology. And it was the chance to do those other things and really to show how many different areas of our lives genetics can help illuminate that I wanted to bring to the book. And I knew there were a lot of great stories out there about not only the history of genetics, but the way that genetics can help us understand our human history, too.
I mentioned The Disappearing Spoon, which is a wonderful book, and you were last on with us for that book. And you write about biology and evolution, now writing about chemistry. Is it a natural progression?
Well, from the first book to this one, from chemistry to biology like this, it is sort of a natural progression. If you think about chemistry as sort of the basis of biology, kind of the fundamental basis for our biology, and this kind of takes a step up the ladder, so to speak. You move from dealing with things like atoms and molecules to dealing with how cells work and things like that. But you can also, in both cases, jump into a lot of really human stories as well. So there's overlap, but yeah, it is kind of a natural progression.
You shouldn't eat polar bears.
No. Well, you can eat most of a polar bear. You should not eat the polar bear liver. That is bad, bad news for you. So if you do eat the liver, it has an incredible amount of vitamin A inside it. And that might sound healthy for us to get lots of vitamin A, but there is just so much vitamin A in a polar bear's liver for various reasons that it ends up poisoning you with it. Arctic explorers learned this lesson the hard way many, many times.
What's fascinating about the book is how you relate that, how you connect that to DNA.
Yeah, what this does inside you, the vitamin A, it does a couple things. It flips a lot of genetic switches inside you, especially with your skin cells. And it also kind of damages the membranes around your cells. So when these Arctic explorers, I mean, some of these people were stranded for months and months up there, had no access to food, and they would shoot polar bears to try to just save themselves. But as soon as they started eating the liver, they'd get these horrific headaches or these terrible pains inside them. And worst of all, their skin would actually start coming off in sheets. It would just peel right off their body, which is sort of a characteristic of vitamin A poisoning. So yeah, the book explains how this really sort of terrible symptom like this comes about in part because of the genes that we have inside us.
What's fascinating about the book is it seems that you are telling us that these are things more for our enrichment, more for us to know and knowledge-based than something that we can use in the future to say, this will cure that.
Yeah, that's one thing I did want to emphasize in the book, that, you know, there's a lot going on with genetics in medicine, but as you said, there's so many other areas that genetics can help illuminate. And it is, in a lot of cases, just satisfying our curiosity about our history, about our past and where we came from. But for a lot of us, that's just as important as our medical needs in some cases. It's something that it's just a drive, I think, in people to understand what our species is like and where we came from and why we are what we are today.
You also make the point that how we often take those terms, DNA and genes, and make them synonymous with one another, but how actually, and you go into in great depth in this, of how they are distinct.
Yeah, I like to say that the genes are like the story of us. They tell the story of us. But DNA is like the language in which the story is written in. And in some sense, they're not separable, but in another sense, they are distinct between them. And as the first few chapters in the book explain, scientists for a long time didn't know that genes and DNA were related. They thought that heredity was controlled by other substances inside the cell. And actually, both of the people who discovered genes and DNA, there were scientists in Europe, both of them died pretty obscure and basically unknown. And it took a long, long time for them to get the recognition that they deserve. So kind of a sad story about the their struggles during their life to get recognition and how it ended up for them.
Most of us, I think, have heard and realize and know something about DNA. You write about RNA. What is that?
RNA is a related molecule, and RNA is sort of a... it's kind of a wonder inside the cell, all the things it can do. DNA is very stable. It's very good at being the blueprint for the cell and carrying instructions from generation to generation. RNA, though, is the one that really executes those instructions. It's the thing that makes things happen inside the cell. And in some ways, it's maybe the more important part of our day-to-day functioning. And as I explained in the book, actually, Watson and Crick, the famous people who discovered the structure of DNA, after they did that, they actually joined something called the RNA Tie Club to try to figure out how RNA worked. That was really the next big mystery. And, you know, it was a club, basically. They joined with their friends where they all wore this special tie that had an RNA strand on it, and they would have these sort of silly meetings discussing this. But the fact that they joined it explains how important a problem RNA was and how solving the RNA question really expanded our knowledge of genetics a lot.
Chapter 4 of the book is The Musical Score of DNA. What kinds of information does DNA store? And in this chapter, you dedicate much of it to the links between DNA and language. How much does that subject, does DNA owe to the study of language?
It owes a surprising amount, actually. If you talk about DNA or you listen to a geneticist talk, you'll start to hear all sorts of what sound like grammar terms. You'll start to hear things like punctuation or syntax, grammar, prefixes, suffixes, all this sort of stuff. And it's not a coincidence. In a lot of ways, DNA really acts like a language. That is what it's meant to do, is to pass information on. But because DNA is a language, it has the ability to, you know, sort of store and transmit stories between the generations. So it was a lot of fun in that chapter to look at the different ways in which, again, DNA really has this sort of deep linguistic structure to it. And of course, my favorite one was probably DNA palindromes, sections of DNA that read the same forward and backward. And, you know, it sounds like it's just a little fluke or something kind of fun, but there's a surprising history about the importance of palindromes to how DNA works. So, again, it was just fun to explore these links between language and DNA, something you might not think to link ahead of time.
And it can be artistic. DNA origami.
Yes, there are a lot of scientists working on this nowadays, DNA origami. The basic idea is that when you're trying to build something on a very small scale, do nanotechnology basically, DNA is a really good substance for doing that. It just has some really nice properties in trying to build things. And scientists doing DNA origami have been able to make, all sorts of kind of funny things. They can make little smiley faces, or they can make Mercator maps of the globe. And nowadays, they're even making sort of more sophisticated things, little DNA walkers that can move around along a predetermined path, or even a little DNA box with a lid and a little DNA key that opens it. It's really kind of amazing, all the things they can make nowadays. And there's a lot of promise in the field that we can finally do a lot of the things we want to do in nanotechnology, but using DNA as the medium to get those things done.
You do tell the story in the book, and it is a wonderful story, but if you could explain the title, The Violinist's Thumb.
Oh, sure. The Violinist's Thumb has to do with Niccolo Paganini. He's usually considered the greatest violinist who ever lived. He was in Europe in the early 1800s, and he played for emperors and kings, and he had coins struck with his likeness, and there were always rumors that he had sold his soul to Satan for his talents. So, again, a very great violinist. And one of the reasons he was so great was he had these kind of freakishly flexible fingers. He could twist them into all sorts of knots and stretch them incredibly wide and just do these incredible things with his hands that other violinists simply couldn't. And it's almost certain that Paganini had a genetic disorder that made his joints incredibly flexible. And I like to tell this story, or I made it the title story, for a few reasons. One reason is that it goes to show that it's genes that really help make us who we are. It's not everything, because Paganini also worked very hard, and he had a passion for music. But we're very lucky that the passion and the hard work combined in someone who had the genetic gifts to be able to take advantage of that. It was kind of a perfect storm of circumstances that made Paganini Paganini. But at the same time, if his genes helped make Paganini, they also unmade him in some sense, because the same thing that gave him flexibility in his joints also caused other health problems. And by the end of his life, he was actually unable to play much music in public, and he ended up dying in a lot of pain. So again, his genes helped make him in one sense, but perhaps unmade him in the end.
The name of the book is The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by Our Genetic Code. The book is published by Little Brown and Company. Sam Keen, a great pleasure. I thank you very much for joining us this morning. Best of luck to you with the book.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Violinist's Thumb and Other Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by Our Genetic Code. It's published by Little Brown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.